Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. First, I would like to thank the organizer for the opportunity of being here. It's really nice. I am an experimentalist working in Lima, in Matera. And those are the things I'm working on. So, of course, today we will speak about avalanches. And I'm trying to do granular experiments and also supercritical fracture experiment, actually with a collaboration, this collaboration with Stefan, in order to approach a little bit earthquakes, also doing some panics in ants in collaboration with Havana, some pattern formation here, and of course just putting physical risk is kind of an attractor for good students and some fun, and it works. So, of course we'll speak about avalanches, and here I'm presenting an experiment we published years ago, where we have a two-dimensional sampai. So this is the pipe here. Forget this for the time being. We are dropping grains this high. Just we drop rain, we take a picture, and then after 1 month of experiment, we get a really good statistics. Yeah, they have a really nice power law with an exponent 1.6.
Two-dimensional,
yeah. This is grains between two glass plates, and it's a spherical beads.
So 1 plus 1 dimensional.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, we are trying to predict the large avalanches or the really big ones.
Are they more dispersed?
Yes, those were more dispersed, but a little bit. But there is a gap between the bits were 4 millimeters, and then the gap was 4.5, so they kind of like that, and so there is some crystals somewhere, but then we see this blue here are crystals, and then there are some disorder as well, and this is really important because that was the disorder free stability. Mm-hmm.
The disorder, it was just, I mean, you were changing the baseline.
Yeah, the first row is blue with the mix, and this is the one that is generated disorder in the pile. So the main idea here was try to predict the big ones, or the really big ones. And of course they are correlated, so the autocorrelation there is nothing. But then when we do the correlation between the large avalanches with the structure of the system, and here the structure is just the kind of a disorder of the system. Yeah, we do the coronoid triangulation. And then, so red is high disorder, blue is a hexagonal lattice. And the...
Sorry, the color
code
is what?
Yeah. No, it's just a borderline triangulation of the centers. And then you see this is really an hexagonal lattice is blue. This is far from an hexagon, okay. It's red. Mm-hmm. So we can say that this is more disordered than that. Okay? And the idea was that when the big avalanche was coming, then the pile started to get disordered. Mm-hmm. I guess this is
so
kind of
precursor.
Exactly. And the idea is, yeah, we know in granular materials, we have two grains here, and then for an avalanche, the grain has to climb up there. So we know that there is the system will delay. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the thing we are seeing here. Mm-hmm. The system delayed before a big avalanche. And thanks to that, we were able to predict. Well, this made some noise in the scientific community, because it was the first time that really big avalanches were predicted inside a power law distributed regime.
So but well, is this then just mostly applicable to crystallizing systems?
Again?
Is it only applicable to crystallizing systems?
No.
Because you wouldn't have this big difference if you didn't have crystallization.
Actually, yes. We'll see. Well, because now, at the beginning, some people say, yeah, it's trivial because we are watching the structure. And then the thing we are doing now is this experiment, where the idea is trying to mimic earthquakes. Mm-hmm. We have a monolayer as well of disk that we press and then we shear. Mm-hmm. So therefore, the last is always very nice. We can see the shear force and everything. But the main idea is we will put acoustic sensors and try to predict with acoustics. And now we are doing mono dispersed and bi dispersed as well. And yeah, we don't see really big difference, because actually we can tune the disorder by the first line there, and the disorder is spreading across the system. Mm-hmm. This is we are sharing here. Of course, with the disk, we get one avalanche. So the disk, the idea is to close this in periodic boundary conditions. So we do here. Mm-hmm. And then we get like a system that will rotate forever and giving avalanches. And yeah, we get power loss, and we are starting now to process all that. But well, we are in the right track.
Sorry, what's the definition of avalanche now?
In the other one was just the number of.
In the previous one it's clear, but
it's clear.
There is nothing being, you are rotating blocks, something like that.
No, we are just shearing the system.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. The effect is that certain parts of crystals rotate, I guess.
No. I mean, imagine that everything is disordered. Mm-hmm. The idea is just, it's like at some point there is a stick slip.
Ah, mm-hmm. So you make a constant force, but the effect is that the movement is by...
Yeah, two. Exactly.
Okay.
And then you will hear that, and the energy is power distributed and everything.
I see, okay.
So
is the length of the slip that gives you the balance?
For the time being, we are measuring the force, but we are also measuring the acoustics, we have the force change, we have everything. So this is a really preliminary result now. But yeah, we have power loss.
And then.
For the time being, it's just constant torque.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. But we can modify everything. So
from this picture, it doesn't look like the ones on the top are glued on. The ones on the bottom, I can see the little halves.
Yeah. This experiment is the result here. That was before shearing. I was just putting the arrows there to explain it. But this was just before shearing and trying to see how the acoustic propagates inside the system. You're right. Here we see the half grains, but here there is nothing.
Mm-hmm. But when you are shearing, there
are? Yeah, there are half grains in both ends.
Is this with friction or without friction?
This is an experiment. Actually, that's something we are going to do, to change friction, because it's a really important parameter. To play with dissipation. Yeah. So those are the things. We are trying to predict avalanches. But then we know that, there are some ideas that say that predicting avalanches is impossible, because those things are critical. Mm-hmm. And that's...
So where does that logic come from? I always stop when I hear these people say,
yes.
If it's critical, then it's unpredictable. If it's critical, then you would think it's... A long time correlation function, so there must be some degree of predictability. So where does that come from?
I will tell you later. But actually, in my definition of criticality, I guess it's the definitionary one, that the correlation length diverges. Mm-hmm, actually, prediction doesn't make any sense, because there are too many big events.
What does that mean? What would you like to predict?
Yeah, exactly. We want to predict the really big avalanches. But for instance, I will show you in the case of earthquakes. Earthquakes, we have one really big one worldwide once a year. Okay, that, of course, we're going to predict that. But if we change the exponent and then we reduce the exponent, we will see that we will have one really big one every 4 minutes. Doesn't make any sense to predict. Just wait 4 minutes and you will get another one.
But they're not Poissonian, right?
Hmm?
They're not Poissonian. Why
do
they accept it?
They're
not
a Poisson process. Yeah, but... So they're clustered.
Maybe we look at it.
Yeah, well... So that's... for me, that's the main idea, yeah. We'll discuss this, the relation between criticality and predictability. Actually, I did the same analysis in the IC model to be sure that it really works. I can show you this later if you want. And this is the standard definition of correlation length that we were discussing about avalanches. So the correlation length is proportional to the largest avalanche or to the cutoff. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that we know. So if we have dissipation in the system, normally there is a cutoff that gets to smaller avalanche sizes. But the exponent is really robust, doesn't change. That's the thing normally that we have. However, we know that 3/2 has to be the maximum of the exponent values. Mm-hmm. At least when we are talking about percolation. Percolation is something that's really easy to understand. Mm-hmm. You have, say again? Okay, well, I will show you which is. Okay, I will show you the ideas I have, and maybe we can discuss later. So for me, the things I learned from percolation is that, yeah, normally for in two dimensions, we have these values in dimension, and then up to the critical dimension, then the fractality of the avalanche, the fractal dimension is 4, and then doesn't change anymore. So, and talking about mean field or the lattice, the vet lattice, we have like 3/2, and that's the maximum in those systems. Okay, and also in the models, that just slowly driven models, like the BTW or the OFC or the MANA models, can have the same as well. And then in two dimensions, I was wondering, all those here, so they are much larger than 3/2, but I guess that's the one we should compare with. There's kind of, for me, it's kind of the critical value for slowly driven systems. Mm-hmm. And then, why this changed? And I think it's because of that. Because dissipation can modify the cutoff by keeping the exponent value, but dissipation can also change the value of the exponent. We should just do some simulations and also we did some experiments and exactly that. We changed the dissipation and we saw that the exponent of the power law was changing. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, in percolation you make quantization and you get the one avalanche, what they call it one avalanche, and they analyze the structure of this avalanche and they do repeat this, you repeat the imagine in a bed lattice. Mm-hmm. In a bed lattice you run the experiment once and you get one avalanche size and you do it many times and you get the distribution.
So this is tau minus one that you're showing here. The tau that's normally measured in percolation would be 2 points.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the idea is, yeah, we will see that the exponent can change due to the dissipation. And then my idea is that, yeah, the things that dissipation is changing, the exponent is like driving the system out of criticality. In experiments, it's easy. Just increase the friction, and then the energy that is going to pass through your neighbors produce. And in the simulation, the same. So I will show you the simulations in a few slides. So that's why if we use this idea of the correlation length, you will see that in this case, it doesn't work quite well. Mm-hmm. So I was planning to propose kind of this.
You're going to talk about this, how this varies?
Yeah, I will. I will show exactly simulations where we see that just in a few minutes. So I will propose this because with this one we can really see both. Mm-hmm. So in this case it has exactly the same behavior as this one, and in this case it really changed with the corner. Okay. Well, just this was just to show the because we like to show really the values the spawning earthquakes. So I just did the analysis of the catalogs and to show here that the Gutenberg is low, as everyone knows, it's really the slope is minus one here. And then by the definition of amplitude of energy, we will get those power laws for the integrated distribution. So then to get this point, you have to integrate all the earthquakes in this area. And then when we did the derivative, we get the laws, the power laws that are fit here. For instance, here we talk about the energy, and we consider there are earthquakes between 0 and magnitude 10. So, and then this rate will fit the data here. There is the red line here. Okay? But that's really good experiments that which are the good spawner here? 2 or 5 or 3? And I guess that's a big question in experimentalism. Because normally, in your edition, you have the spawning, and you sometimes the experimentalist wants to match the experiment with the theory, and then which is the one exponent or the one that will depend for the definition of the avalanche. Here is here, for instance, we have this power law here, and then we can write S as a linear S to the power of the dimension, for instance, the case, the most common case is this one. We have the energy, and then we see that the energy is, you can write it as the square of the amplitude. So we use this a lot. Well, we get this, and then we just put the substitute here, and then we get, the idea is that we get two different exponents describing the situation, of course, because we are defining the avalanche in a different way. Of course, it's trivial. And the main question is, which is the one to use? And I guess, so we are, even if we're talking about this or about that, it's the same. How we have to define avalanches is we want to talk about criticality or one correction length. Of course, this has to be the volume, or in two dimensions, the area of the avalanche. That's the only way to get this in a length dimension. Otherwise, we will get, push energy here, then we will get whatever here. So that's why, I guess that's really important for experimentalists to really know where you're measuring. And we know that the energy will spread and then it will decrease at the square of the distance.
Why? So in a granular system? Why should
in general, I guess. This is just the story has spreading loss.
But you're talking about your granular system.
No, we are talking here about earthquakes.
Yeah, but also you want to compare it to a granular system.
We are putting acoustics and you will know that the signal that you are measuring.
You know that? That it goes at 1 over R squared?
Well, it's in the case of spherical spreading loss, it's trivial, no?
No, it's not.
I mean, that's the first approximation. You get the point, and in 3D, it will, it's in a sphere.
Under what assumptions?
I get
conservation of energy.
Yeah, conservation of energy.
No,
but I mean,
no,
if
they're elastic material.
If they're force chains, it's very inhomogeneous.
Of course, no. And of course. This is the of course. Yeah, this is the first approximation in earthquakes, and it works. And that was for defining which of those to use. If to use the energy, if to use the amplitude, and we need an avalanche size that has information about the area of the
I just want you to make sure, because you're going to ultimately compare to granular systems, and I don't think this is true for granular systems.
Actually, but the ballistics works as well in granular systems. So the paper that was just the cover of Perel, that was a few months ago, that was a ballistic part that there was what you were using.
Can I ask you about the correlation length and the relation to the correlation length to the average mean amount of size that you indicate there? Size is proportional in blue there?
That's the thing I would propose in a few slides.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So for this is kind of the standard we are using now, no? That the correlation length is
perfect. Tricky, right? S max doesn't exist. Do you know that there's a maximum average
length? In a finite system, yeah, of course.
Well, okay, well, what do you?
In all systems, all experimental systems are finite.
It doesn't mean that the average size is finite. But I understand in your case it is.
I mean, earthquakes, I mean, you will never get something larger than 10. Magnitude 10. That's a sixth.
Okay.
Is anybody thinking, because when you talk of earthquakes, you are talking of catalysts that accumulate data from different poles. What is really the characteristic size? It's the size of the pole.
I agree.
If you have a fault network, then talking of a catalyst, there is no characteristic earthquake. In California.
I agree.
There is a characteristic earthquake on a single pole.
But there is always a maximum that is related with the system size.
I'm sure you measure only over finite time, right?
Yeah, but even I mean, the system size is finite, you can't get something larger than the system size. This is it's impossible. So that's also for really putting the relevance of the quantum value here. So this is the, as you said, the right value for the good enough, it's a low in terms of energy. That is this line here. And the thing I'm doing here is just trying to change the exponent. Just change the exponent from 1 to 2 and see how will be the statistics. Mm-hmm. Of course, keeping this. Let's keep the same number of earthquakes. And let's redistribute those with different exponent values. So here is the real one. So we get one really big per year. It's this one here. So one really big per year between A and 9. And then if we imagine that the critical value will be 1.5, then it will be almost every second day will be a bigger earthquake. And if we put the value in 1.27, that was the one that was showing you there for the slowly driven system with simulations, we will get one really big one in every 4 minutes. So I guess sometimes when people talk about earthquakes, I say, they show a power law, say, it's like earthquakes. Watch out, because I mean, the difference are huge. Just change the little bit exponent value, the result, this has nothing to do with that. And then, for me, what you said, it's possible to the relation between criticality and predictability. I mean, if we all agree that this is critical or this is critical, then here, it doesn't make any sense to predict anything.
But the smoke sound there depends crucially on the normalization, right? So how will we...
I just put this in numbers, but you can make the just percentage between small and big. It's the same. So here is if you have a exponent one, all of them will be with the same, all magnitudes will have the same.
It assumes that all of these avalanches follow the power law distribution.
Right? Yeah, of course.
The vast majority of them, very many of these, will be in an area that will be very small avalanches and there will be not under the power law.
The
power law is only describing an asymptotic
behavior,
doesn't it?
Well, that's the catalog there.
Maybe the things that should be really conserved in this modelization is the total amount of energy, not the total number. And in the total amount of energy, this non-universal part should be depressing because it is multiplied by small value. Sorry, I don't know this.
Well, for me, this was only for really putting the importance of the how to define this. So in this case, it's the energy, the good exponent, because it's proportional to the area of the avalanche, the earthquakes. And also be aware of the difference, the huge difference that can barrier conditions a little bit disappointing. And I guess for the two cases there, I guess this is the most important part. That this the this model where is the trying to mimic here a tectonic plate. So this is moving slowly, and then there are blocks here. There are friction between the blocks and this plate that is fixed, and there are springs between the blocks. So this is pushing. There is springs also here. Eventually, when one block will overcome the friction threshold, and he will move, but he's attached to the other ones. So eventually or not, we will try also to move the other ones. And the size of the avalanche will be the how many they move, how many blocks they move.
But there is no experiment with this.
Earthquakes experiment, I guess.
That's
the model.
Similar to this.
In the sample experiment, we changed the dissipation, and we also saw the variation in the wind. So then, Olavi-Ferran and Christensen, they just put this into the cellular automata. It's really, the rules are really simple. So it just the force is increasing a little bit in time, and then there are thresholds, and when the force reaches threshold, there is a local avalanche, and the most important thing here is dissipation. There is a local avalanche, so the energy is redistributed to the four neighbors, near neighbors, but not all the energy. One part of the energy is dissipated. And those are the results. And I guess that's really interesting here, because this is the critical value. When there is no dissipation at all, then for 1% dissipation or 2% dissipation, we saw this as the, so we had a little bit of dissipation, and then we see that there is a cutoff moving, so that's the thing we see here, those two. So here we are just putting the dissipation and the value exponent, so it decreases a little bit, but it's kind of a constant here. And this was a really strange happening, that the behavior changed from this way to this one. So dissipation continued increasing, and then here there is a transition here, that we see here. So then the curve starts to recover the power law. So of course there are cutoff here proportional to the system size, but this effect here disappeared. And then there is another effect, there is that the spawning start to move, to change.
It's increasing
the dissipation.
The alpha of your.
Yes, the dissipation is the alpha, yeah. The dissipation is always increasing this way. And we see here the. So in this, for really small dissipation, we have this.
Is that just because the system size?
No, I guess we will expect that this will reduce. It's your increased dissipation. But something really strange happened here, that the system changed the behavior and changed from this way to that way. And this is the way that is, again, popular for this system. I never seen this in this system before. So I guess I did because I got really low values of dissipation. And then I saw the first part. And this is really interesting because we really see the change from here to here.
So you're doing numerics?
This is numerics, yeah. This is just this model. And
the log is 10 or E? Basis of the log is 10?
It's 10.
Excuse me, I apologize.
No, it's okay.
The reason why Olavi-Ferran and Christensen proposed this model,
yes,
is because the Bady-Chernikov model, that is the spring-work model without dissipation, doesn't give the right exponent. So they proposed this model introducing the local dissipation precisely to reproduce the experimental exponent of the earthquake distribution.
I agree.
So the fact that the exponent changes with dissipation was the main aim of their work. So I have a problem in understanding what you are trying to enlighten with this result. I mean, what I am supposed to understand from this analysis was not in your C paper.
Oh yeah, exactly. This is there is your nothing new here. There is nothing new here. Okay. The only thing new is that here we see both. In the OECC, we don't see this part. We don't see this part that the cutoff is retreating, and the spawning is robust. So for really adult
species, in fairness, there has been a lot of discussion in the literature whether there is A, an exponent at all, and B, whether it survives, say,
rates
of more than 10%. And even if that is true, whether there are any artifacts that are actually driving these.
Artifact
is what you are actually observing, not the model.
Actually, we did experiments. We did the sample experiments that work with an exponent 1.6. We just put all the grains in acid, so they get really rough. We repeat the experiment, and we really get a slope with 1.8. So I guess it's and now we are doing simulations now, trying to get more points. So we got 2 points. We are preparatory to do numerical simulations, try to see something like that, to see if we really can get the variation. Oh, here, there is kind of a linear variation in this area here with the dissipation. That's something we are doing now.
I'm evidently the less expert here in the thing, but am I the only one to be surprised by the fact that critical exponents are there with a parameter of the model that moves, and furthermore, they move continuously in a.
Yeah, of course, that was the big point of the OOC model. That was the big point. And everybody is very surprised, and then people are saying, well, maybe there are no exponents, or maybe this is an American artifact. It's very, very, very difficult to pin down, really difficult to pin down. And I think if you talk to the C in the OFC, then he would probably say, well, things are pretty settled for the non-dissipative model, but as soon as you turn on dissipation, things get murky. I mean, there are other models that have continuously varying exponents, things like pretty phenomenon of which.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah. Well, in this case, the thing that is clear is that this doesn't work. Because dissipation is increasing. And then here, I mean, the horizon length is decreasing, but then here it's increasing again. That's why I was the idea of saying that, because here we see that this is monotonous with the dissipation. And,
but you can calculate that relation, right? It's not the right relation. You can determine, as a tall feature in this relation, the mean S is not, if xi is a length, then there's a cutoff S max that goes like xi to the dA. And then you can determine this relation.
Yeah, well, we'll have to discuss that later. Okay. But also for me, for the statistical point of view, there is, I mean, the first one is the largest possible response that the system can give to perturbation. And the second one is the average response that the system got to perturbation. You agree on that? For me, if you're talking statistical physics, equilibrium statistical physics, this is a microstate. This is a special microstate. If we want it to get something, we have to make the average. And then if we do it, of course, this is really trivial, we get this. And in the critical, for the critical value, we get with that. And then we can write the correlation length as a function of the exponent. Mm-hmm. And then, in the case of low dissipation, when we see that the exponent is robust, but the cutoff is moving, then we get the same. We get a correlation length that is proportional to the cutoff. Mm-hmm. So in this case, it's the same. But in this case, not. In this case, we get really that the correlation length will be decreasing exponentially with the exponent value. And then, since we can do it, just measure it. So, of course, this is so here offering the correlation as a function of B minus critical B.
Can you say again what the mean SC is in this?
That was the. Is this? It's considered just the critical value. So you do this for an exponent, and then you say in the critical situation is the when there is no dissipation, then SC is the mean value of this situation.
It's the S max of the non-dissipative system.
Exactly.
May I make a very small digression? I hope it's small. If I'm not wrong, vertex operator form a family, continuous family of operators that have continuously varying exponents. Maybe the dissipation parameter is changing the interpretation of what you do experimentally into a vertex of operator of a given parameter. This would be consistent.
Well, the things I did to. I guess it's tomorrow. The so I just directly measure the correlation function. So, of course, if you plot this, it's just the black hair. Of course, it's an exponential decay. This is in there. But we can do it directly. We can do the autocorrelation of the force. And for there, calculate the correlation length. No, I did it with the, before doing this, I did it with the IC model. Exactly the same procedure. Copy, I put it in the code. And then we do it in the OFC, I get that.
When do you measure the forces? During the avalanches or while the system is collapsing?
The system is stable, after the avalanche. It works. Okay.
But if you do the same in other models, then you get a correlation length of 1 or something like that. It's completely ridiculous. It doesn't scale. There's no correlation in such
thing
in the Poisson state.
But it's really striking. So it's, and this is there is nothing there. It's the direct way to do it. There is no assumptions, no crazy ideas there. So the only crazy idea is taking the average in time. But, well, I guess we can skip that. And that's it. So for me, that's the main idea was that dissipation can not only change the cutoff and keep the value, but can also change the value of this one. And we see in the OFC model, but we have checked this in experiment. It works. In this case, this doesn't work because then this doesn't change. The cutoff doesn't change. The cutoff is always the side of the system. You are putting dissipation. The mean value is reducing, but the cutoff doesn't change. So this doesn't work for this case. And this, at least in the things I showed there, we're working. And it worked for both.
Well, the reason why it doesn't work is because in the proportionality, you're hiding the fact that there's a bridge factor that is independent, that is dependent on the dissipation rate. So it doesn't work because you're assuming it's the same bridge factor, but nobody says that.
Well, it's an exponential. It's not a factor. It's an exponential decay. Well, with this, we can get the criticality, and then this can tell us how far we are from the critical value. It's a critical value for me was the kind, the value where there was no dissipation. And that's it. Thank you.
There's one more question for you.
Maybe I just want to make a comment that if you want to, just from what I have learned at this workshop, I think if you want to compare to the granular system, to me it seems it's more like the VR cross E-link transition, and probably has different physics than this kind of physics transition that I think there are. To me, knowing more about granular systems, I think that's a better model for this kind of avalanches than the OFC model that we talked about.
Okay.